From Pacifico Radio, this is Democracy Now!
My name is Fountain Hughes. I was born in Charlottesville, Virginia. My grandfather belonged to Thomas Jefferson. My grandfather was 115 years old when he died.
Should corporations who profited from slavery have to pay reparations today? We'll look at the growing movement in the United States. Then, the soft vengeance of a freedom fighter. A conversation with South African Supreme Court Justice Albie Sachs. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. In a sally that could broaden his support among Arab American voters concentrated in so-called battleground states, Ralph Nader accused Democratic presidential rival Al Gore of being cowardly in his stated support for Israel Sunday night and suggested a more sympathetic approach toward the Palestinians could produce a Middle East peace settlement sooner than anticipated. At yet another fundraising rally last night at the University of California, Davis, the Green Party candidate told approximately 1,400 supporters that there will be, quote, no peace in that area without justice for the Palestinians. And this news from Jerusalem, with peace receding as clashes intensified, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Barak appealed to hawkish opposition leader Ariel Sharon to join a coalition government, a move that further dashed hopes of reconciliation. Fighting did not abate overnight last night. Exchanges of fire continued in the divided West Bank city of Hebron. A 55-year-old Palestinian man was killed at his house when he was hit in the head by gunfire. The fighting sparked by Sharon's visit on September 28th to the Temple Mount in Jerusalem. Since then, more than 124 people have been killed, the vast majority Palestinian. This news from Denver. The scores of American Indians killed in a U.S. Army massacre 136 years ago will be memorialized under legislation sponsored by a descendant of the victims and awaiting President Clinton's signature. The bill was passed by vote yesterday, voice vote, in the House and by the Senate earlier. Clinton has indicated he'll sign it. More than 150 Cheyenne and Arapaho Indians died November 29, 1864, when nearly 1,000 men, under the command of Colonel John M. Chivington, surrounded hundreds of Indians camped on the banks of the creek. Historians say when the first shots were fired, Cheyenne Chief Black Kettle raised an American flag and a white cloth of truce. It drew more fire. One soldier, Captain Silas Soule, later described to Congress the gruesome scene where troops slaughtered Cheyenne and Arapaho women, children, and elderly men. And this news from the United Nations. Human rights and women's groups are making a major push to ensure that women in war zones are protected against rape and sexual abuse, and that women have an equal role with men in peace negotiations. The UN Security Council was to hold a debate today on the impact of war on women. Grassroots groups met privately with the 15 council members yesterday on behalf of hundreds of local women's organizations struggling to end war and restore peace to their ravaged communities. A statement from the group said that in ethnic conflicts, women and girls are sexually assaulted, raped, and murdered. Women are also indirect victims of war, fleeing their homes to escape attack and winding up in refugee camps where they're forced into prostitution, trafficking, and criminal activities in order to survive. This news from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. In the past decade, dozens of Wisconsin inmates have died under questionable circumstances in the state's prison health care system. This according to an 8-month investigation by the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. The newspaper reported Sunday that its examination of every inmate death since 1994 and several previous deaths revealed practices and policies at the Wisconsin Department of Corrections that raised concerns about prisoners' access to basic, potentially life-saving medical treatment. Although the head of the state prisons defended the quality of medical care for prisoners, the investigation underscored concerns raised this year after the death of asthmatic inmate Michelle Greer. Greer's death, which officials have said may have been prevented if she'd easier access to a handheld asthma inhaler, was among dozens of similarly questionable deaths the newspaper found when examining records of police in the Department of Corrections for 14 sites in 11 counties. In Charleston, South Carolina, radioactive water leaked from a cracked pipe at a nuclear power plant, but in a small quantity that, at least according to officials, say did not endanger workers or the public. In this news from Lima, Peru, the ominous return of Peru's feared former spy chief, Vladimir Montesinos, after a brief exile confirmed for many the widely held belief that he, more than President Alberto Fujimori, is calling the shots. And opposition leaders and analysts say topping Vladimir Montesinos' agenda is a desperate bid for laws granting amnesty from prosecution for himself and his cronies who dominate Peru's armed forces. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. This past month, California Governor Gray Davis signed the Slaveholder Insurance Policy Law, which requires all insurers whose businesses date to the 19th century to review their archives and make public the names of insured slaves and the slaveholders through the state's insurance commissioner. Under a typical $11 a year policy in the 1800s, a slave owner received $500 when a slave died. This new legislation makes California the first state to require insurance companies that sold slave policies in the 1800s to open their archives to the public. Prompted by the apology issued in March by Aetna over its role in selling slave owners' policies on enslaved blacks, the laws are the latest in a growing movement to redress the country's legacy of slavery and oppression. In May, Chicago joined Los Angeles, Detroit, Washington, and half a dozen other cities in passing resolutions urging the federal government to study the reparations issue. The California law, however, stops short of permitting descendants of the slaves to sue the companies, making only a partway successful attempt by reparations supporters who increasingly are turning their attention toward insurers, banks, and other businesses that may have profited from slavery. Reparations activists say that corporate archives hide the details of how many enslaved black people lived, worked, and died, and they're calling for reparations from these corporations. Today, we're going to look at the issue of reparations. In just a few minutes, we're going to go to a speech by TransAfrica founder Randall Robinson, given just a few weeks ago in New Jersey at the Black Issues Forum. But before we do that, we're going to go to the Library of Congress and Smithsonian and to a production they did mastering the original recordings of slaves interviewed in the 1930s and 20s under the FDR Works Progress Administration, where people like writer Zora Neale Hurston were paid by the government to go out and record the voices of former slaves. This is an excerpt of that project called Remembering Slavery, African Americans Talk About Their Personal Experience of Slavery and Emancipation.
My name is Fountain Hughes. I was born in Charlottesville, Virginia. My grandfather belonged to Thomas Jefferson. My grandfather was 115 years old when he died. And now I am 101 years old.
The Fountain Hughes interview was recorded in 1949. At that time, he had been living in Baltimore for about 40 years.
You talk about how old you are, Uncle Fountain. You,
well,
how far back do you remember?
Well, I tell you, things come to me in spells, you know. I remember things more when I'm laying down than I do when I'm standing, when I'm walking around. Mm-hmm. Now, in my boy days, boys lived quite different from the way they live now. Oh, you wore a dress like a woman till I was, I'd be 10, 12, 13 years old.
So you wore a dress, though?
Yes, I didn't wear no pants because they didn't make boys' pants. Boys wore dresses. Well, the women's wearing the pants now, and the boys wearing the dresses. Still.
Who did you work for, Uncle Fountain, when...
Who did I work for?
Yeah.
You mean when I was a slave?
Yeah, when you were a slave, who did you work for?
Well, I belonged to Burness when I was a slave. My mother belonged to Burness, but we didn't know nothing. Didn't allow you to look at no book. And there were some freeborn colored people where they had a little education, but there were very few of them where we was. And we all had a, what you call, I might call it now, a jail sentence. We were just same as we were in jail. Now, I couldn't go from here across the street, or I couldn't go to nobody's house without I have a note or something from my master. And if I had that pass, that was what we call a pass. If I had that pass, I could go wherever he sent me, and I'd have to be back. Whoever he sent me to, they'd give me another pass, and I'd bring that back, so to show how long I'd been gone. We couldn't go out and stay an hour or 2 hours or something like that. But they'd give me a note so there wouldn't nobody interfere with me to tell who I belonged to. And when I come back, I'd carry it to my master and give that to him. That'd be all right. But I couldn't just walk away like the people does now, you know. It's what they call, we were slaves, we belonged to people. They sell us like they sell horses and cows and hogs and all like that, have an auction bench, and they put you on up on the bench and bid on you, the same as you're bidding on cattle, you know.
Was that in Charlotte that you were a slave?
Hmm?
Was that in Charlotte or Charlottesville?
That was in Charlottesville.
Charlottesville, Virginia.
They sell the women, sell the men. All the difference. And then if they had any bad ones, they'd sell them to the nigger traders, what they call the nigger traders, and they'd ship them down south and sell them down south. But otherwise, if you were a good person, they wouldn't sell you. But if you were bad and mean, they didn't want to beat you and knock you around, they'd sell you to the what they call a nigger trader. They'd have a regular. I was sailed every month, you know, at the courthouse. And then they'd sell you maybe $200, $100, $500.
You're listening to excerpts of a project of the Smithsonian Institution, the actual recordings of former slaves talking about their experiences. Many of these interviews done in the 1920s and 30s were gathered in Southern state archives, many of them destroyed, others inaudible, then collected by the Smithsonian and the Library of Congress, remastered, and now part of a project called Remembering Slavery, African Americans Talk About Their Personal Experiences of Slavery and Emancipation. And from that, we now move to Randall Robinson, who is an internationally renowned advocate for human rights and democracy, executive director of TransAfrica, and its founder. Randall Robinson was speaking recently in New Jersey at the Black Issues Forum on the issue of reparations.
Just last week, on Friday night, as a matter of fact, at about 11 o'clock, my son, who 3 years ago finished Howard University. My son was in Los Angeles. He went to Los Angeles after he finished law school, after he finished college, to work to prepare to go to law school. I think he wanted to go to law school because his daddy went to law school. But he is a good son, and he has always tried to do the right thing. On Friday night at about 11 o'clock, he was standing with a friend beside his car. And all of a sudden, they were bathed in floodlights from a helicopter that hovered above. Then they were surrounded by Los Angeles policemen. guns drawn, one of which was pointed in my son's face. And then my son was handcuffed along with his friend and put on his knees in the street of Los Angeles to kneel beside his car for 1 hour and a half without being told what he was being held for and almost afraid to ask. He called me and he said, "Daddy, we have to do something. Racial profiling came home to my family last week." Now, this is something that we can see. This is something that is obvious to us. But all too often we talk about racial profiling as if that were the most offensive feature of a discriminatory criminal justice system. It is not. It is what we cannot see or do not see that is more offensive still. Power never tells its victims what its victims need to know to liberate themselves. We have to discover that for ourselves. If you expect the horse to pull the wagon, you must put blinders on the horse, or the horse will not pull. People who do not know what is going on above them and under them and around them are tantamount to horses pulling a wagon. Many years ago, 200 years ago, plantation owners in the state of South Carolina knew that rice had great value as an American export. What they didn't know was how to grow it. And so they kidnapped slaves from Sierra Leone who knew how to grow rice. And they brought them to the low country of South Carolina and made them grow the rice that made the slave owners rich. A member of Congress who is not Donald Payne sat next to my wife on a plane about 4 months ago. And the member of my Congress asked my wife, she said, "Do you know anything about how one can go about buying stock in these new private prisons?" And as I tell you this story, I want you to think about how history repeats itself. And I want you to know that even during slavery, the people who benefited from slavery had a spin to put on it. They probably called it full employment. They probably called it civilizing. They called it everything but inhumane. And because they owned everything and had the biggest microphones, they even convinced some of the victims that it was not such a bad idea. Now, across this country, we're building private prisons. And when you own stock in the private prison, when the rate or the number of prisoners goes up, so does your stock can't run a profitable private prison without prisons. In the last 20 years, as public prisons, beginning with a liberal Democratic governor, Governor Cuomo, New York started its prison building operation. In 20 years, the state of New York has doubled its prisons. There's a little town in upstate New York called Malone. Malone was the place where Dutch Schultz was tried long ago in the middle 30s. It has been falling into ruin ever since. Hotel closed, corporations gone, people desperate, an all-white town. And so Malone said to the state, what we need are some private prisons. What we need are some public prisons. What we need are some people locked up in Malone. And so the tiny town of Malone competed and won the construction of two New York State public prisons. And for their trouble, they got 1,400 new jobs for their whites and 18 new holes for their golf course.
Randall Robinson, founder and executive director of Trans Africa, speaking at the Black Issues Forum in New Jersey several weeks ago. We'll be back with him in just a minute here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman as we continue with the speech of Randall Robinson, executive director of Trans Africa based in Washington, D.C., and author of the book The Debt, What America Owes to Blacks.
But 80+% of the people housed in Malone's two prisons are black and Hispanic. The beneficiaries are white. The victims are black. And under the Rockefeller laws, all one has to do for the first time is to commit a nonviolent drug offense. Worse for crack than it is for powder. We know who uses the crack. We know who uses the other stuff. And away you go for 15 years. This country is on a prison building binge. Wherever you see a road sign, you will be seeing competition for a new prison that our tax dollars buy. The prisoners are usually us, the people who benefit from their construction are usually them. History repeats itself. For this, my friends, is the modern slavery. And if we don't know the history, we don't know how to fight these current kinds and forms of liberation. For 246 years, this country participated in the longest running crime against humanity the world has seen over the last 500 years. Those who tell me slavery was a long time ago forget to remember that the Voting Rights Act was passed in 1965. Forget to remember that tacked on to slavery was 100 years of de jure segregation and discrimination that continued slavery into the 20th century. And so we have this enormous gap in America. I heard the senator say earlier tonight that we have made progress. I think perhaps I know better than he. I grew up in the Old South. I never met a white person until I was 21 years old. I never saw the inside of a bowling alley until I was a grown man. I remembered arriving at Harvard Law School at age 26, going into the cafeteria and picking up a donut, biting into that donut, and thinking that it was the stalest donut I'd ever seen until somebody told me it was a bagel. Never seen a bagel. Never heard of a bagel. And so I know how far we have come. But I also know how far we have not come. In the last analysis, if you have no economic power, you have no power. And as we assemble here tonight, perhaps African Americans have the lowest unemployment rate in history. But it is twice that of white Americans. We sit here tonight, and I know that a certain tiny group of middle-class Americans have done well enough. But I know that at the same time, poor African Americans are worse off than they have ever been. We sit here tonight, and I know for every dollar a white American makes, an African-American makes 71 cents. We sit here tonight, and I know for those African-Americans who complete 4 years of college against their white counterparts who make a dollar, that African-American makes 72 cents. For 4 years of college, we gain one penny against the field. I sit here tonight and know that whites have considerable financial assets, the measure of wealth, and blacks have none. Even for blacks who wear nice suits and drive nice cars and brandish college degrees, most of us, because our parents bequeathed nothing to us because they had nothing to bequeath, most of us are two paydays from poverty. Is inherited intergenerational. And so it behooves all of us to know the history. History is taught for not as a punishment to young people. It is not a cruel lesson we want to inflict on students. People invest in the instruction of history so that people feel empowered by it. If you know where you came from, if you know how great your people have been, you know that you can be great again. And so we're taught a history that is part truth and part lie, but little of which has anything to do with us. Perhaps the worst crime committed against a people would be to deny those people their story. And so when we came to this country in the holds of slave ships, we lost in the first few generations that which defined us as a people who knew who we were. We lost our languages, we lost our religions, we lost our mothers, we lost our fathers, we lost our children, we lost our very cultural memory of where we've been and who we were, so that most of us can't remember or know anything beyond Harriet Tubman in the days of slavery. Most of us are left with the mistaken notion that Africa had no history. And so, to worsen the crime, when the Emancipation Proclamation came, some people started the race rich. Other people started the race penniless, illiterate, and without prospect, faced into a hostile South. Cotton produced more in income for this federal treasury than all other American exports put together. This country in 1865 was already a powerful country because of cotton, tobacco, and rice. Everybody associated with it became rich. People who built the ships got rich. The people who made the rope to outfit the ships got rich. The people who made the cork to repair the ships got rich. Slavers north, south, from Massachusetts to Mississippi got rich. Plantation owners got rich. Aetna Life Insurance Company insured the lives of slaves. The Brown brothers in Providence, Rhode Island, made their first piece of wealth building slave ships with which they started Fleet Bank and Brown University. The first buildings of Georgetown University were built by slaves who were later sold to a plantation in Louisiana. The Capitol of the United States was built by slaves. The Statue of Freedom that sits atop the Capitol was cast in Bladensburg, Maryland, and hoisted in five pieces to the top of the Capitol of the world's greatest democracy, all done by slaves. And so everybody benefited, but the people who produced the wealth, they were never paid. It's like saying we're going to have a 100-yard dash. We're going to let this runner take off down the track, put this runner in a wonderful uniform, and train the hell out of him, and let him go. This runner over here, we're gonna hold back until this runner here is off and running for 5 seconds just to make sure we're gonna take a gun and shoot this runner in one of his knees. And then tell him after 5 seconds, Donald Payne, go catch him. You will never catch him. It is not designed that we catch up. Because people who victimize people never tell the victims what they did or why they did it. Coming into this century, if anyone had the impression that slavery ended in 1865, let me disabuse you of that notion tonight. State of Georgia built no classrooms. Early in the 20th century, we went to school in the back rooms of churches. By the turn of the century, 80% of the blacks who were lynched were black businessmen. It was focused lynching. We had black codes and peonage laws in the 1920s, meaning that the son of the plantation owner of slavery could go to jail and buy out a vagrant who was in jail because he couldn't get a job, and he couldn't get a job because he was illiterate, and put that vagrant to work on the same plantation under the same conditions in the 1920s. I was 10 years old before restrictive covenants were struck down by the Supreme Court. The principal wealth-building tool in America for middle-class Americans is home equity. Because of restrictive covenants and redlining, Blacks have lost in wealth per generation some $80 billion. University of California at Berkeley did a study to discover from 1929 to 1969. In job discrimination alone, the consequence to the black community has been $1.6 trillion. Sound the gun, run, catch up if you can. It was not designed that we catch up. And then we come to talk about reparations. And then we see, sadly, some of our own people run away from the position. Not many months ago, I was introduced to speak at the Treasury Department by the Deputy Secretary of Treasury, Stuart Eisenstadt. Stuart Eisenstadt last year had been designated by the President of the United States with the support of both bodies of Congress to use the might and clout and influence of America to cause 16 German corporations to provide reparations to Jews who had been used as slave laborers during 12 years of Nazi terror. 16 corporations, including Volkswagen, settled for $5+ billion. Our country said that Germany must be caused to own up to its past and do the right thing. Our country has said that to Serbia. Our country has said that to Rwanda. Our country has said that to South Africa with its Truth and Reconciliation Commission. Our country said that to Japan in recognizing what it had done to Korean women forced into prostitution during World War II. Our country said it to Canada that it had to face up what Canada has done to the first Canadians, the native Canadians. Our country has said it to Australia. Our country has said it to every nation on earth that inflicted injury upon subsets of its own population. But our country has never said it to itself. 3 years ago, when I was writing the book, The Debt, my wife asked me to go down to the Capitol, Donald, and look up in the rotunda. I told her, I said, darling, I used to work in the Capitol. I don't understand why I've got to go down there. But I learned something a long time ago that young men need to learn. It just makes for better marriages. You know, young men don't like to talk. They don't, the wife says, can we talk? And the young man doesn't want to talk. He doesn't want to move the furniture. He just doesn't want to discuss it. But I have learned that sometimes it is just best to do what you're told. Particularly when not a lot turns on it, just whether it makes sense to you or not, do what the woman tells you to do. You see how many potential happy marriages there are in this room? And so I went down to the Capitol, and she said, go into the rotunda and look up. And I did that. And on the eye of the dome of the capital of the most powerful democracy on earth, there's a painting that was painted by Constantino Brumidi and inserted on the eye of the dome in 1864 as the Civil War was drawing to a close. It is called The Apotheosis of George Washington. And in the painting, we see George Washington surrounded by 60 robed figures, in front of whom we see a banner unfurled that says, E pluribus unum, out of many, one. But all 60 of the figures are white. You drop down to the hat band of the dome on the inside, and you see depicted the stages of American history from the dawn, from the age of exploration to the dawn of aviation. No Tubman, no Douglas, no Truth, no blacks at all. And then you drop down to floor level in the Capitol and you see these huge oil paintings. And the only person of color you see at all is Pocahontas in an English church. Once Pocahontas had been co-opted and brought over to the English way of life, she was acceptable to the founders of our nation. But no blacks at all. But what you're not told is that the Arco sandstone blocks into which the paintings are inserted were mined in Stafford County, Virginia, by slaves. They were brought up the Potomac River by slaves. They were offloaded on the east grounds of the Capitol by slaves. They were put in place and fixed there by mortar mixed by slaves, the same slaves who cleared the forest between the White House and the Capitol, same slaves who built the White House of the United States of America. They were not only never paid, they were never acknowledged. So my daughter and I walked the grounds of the mall one day, and off to our right, we saw the Jewish Holocaust Memorial Museum that is there to remember those who died during World War II in Europe. We saw the space where the National Indian Museum is going up. We saw off in the distance the area in which the Japanese Memorial Park to remember the Japanese who were interned in the United States during World War II. We walked from Lincoln to the Capitol. We saw not a tablet. We saw not a brick. We saw not a monument that commemorated the lives of the some 50 million sons and daughters of Africa who died in the middle passage into American slavery. History forgets first those who forget themselves. If you want the horse to pull the wagon, first you put blinders on the horse. Thank you very much.
Randall Robinson, speaking at the Black Issues Forum in New Jersey several weeks ago. He's author of The Debt, What America Owes to Blacks, and executive director of TransAfrica, based in Washington, D.C. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Back in a minute. Listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman, and we're joined in the studio by Albie Sachs. On April 7th, 1988, an activist South African lawyer and a leading member of the ANC was car-bombed in Maputo, the capital of Mozambique, by agents of South Africa's security forces. His right arm was blown off, and he lost the sight of one eye. Albie Sachs is now a justice of the Constitutional Court of South Africa, which is the equivalent of our Supreme Court, and he joins us in the studio now. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you. Happily, one doesn't need two arms and two eyes to serve as a justice on our court.
Well, it's a great privilege to have you here. And since I started with that introduction of what happened to you 12 years ago, if you wouldn't mind, if we could go back to that day, what did happen in Mozambique?
Well, I had to kind of reconstruct what happened because I was on my way to the beach. It was a public holiday. And just suddenly everything went dark. And I thought I'd banged my head on something, the kind of concussion I used to get when I used to climb the mountain. And I thought, well, it'll go away, it'll clear. And it didn't clear. The darkness got heavier and heavier. And then I realized something terrible had happened to me. And well, it's a longer story, which I've written about in some detail so that I don't have to, you know, constantly recall the details. But the net result was as you mentioned, that I lost an arm and the sight of an eye. I had a long, long, long operation, and but came together again and had a recovery that I actually found quite joyous. It was like a second chance at life, down to the little details of learning to tie a shoelace. And I wanted to say, look, Mommy, I can tie my shoelace, and to write with my left hand. I used to write with my right hand before. I might say I was hoping that I'd have a better handwriting because I had a real feeble schoolboy's handwriting, and I thought, now's my chance. You know these fountain pens they advertise on the television with that kind of very macho, forceful, aristocratic writing? And it came out exactly the same as it used to be, like a schoolboy's rather feeble writing. But all these were interesting discoveries, and I felt as I was recovering and learning to do everything from bodily functions, to walk, to get around, to be active with my body, so South Africa was recovering from states of emergency, from imprisonment. And I had an intense optimism that we would make it, and make it quite soon. And as they say, so it came to pass.
What were you doing in Mozambique?
I was there in exile. I'd spent 11 years in England and 11 in Mozambique as an exile, as a lawyer. I was working as a law professor in the Ministry of Justice. I had been a professor at the university there before. And we put on workshops on shipping law, on family law, on community tribunals, a whole range of things. It was very, very interesting work, and I was very active in the cultural sphere. Got to know many artists, sculptors, would go to the theater in the midst of war, with great famine, with terrible, terrible problems. There was a feeling for culture that I found in very few countries in the world.
But going to Mozambique, did it have anything to do with the politics of South Africa?
Oh, well, I was in exile because I'd been imprisoned in South Africa in solitary confinement a couple of times, and I was about to be thrown out of the legal profession on purely political grounds, so it was almost impossible to function there. So I went to England. I was stateless for many, many years. Got re-established my life, if you like, in England. But when Mozambique became independent in 1975, I managed to visit there shortly after that and ended up getting a job and just loved working there despite all the difficulties. I was back in Africa, and the problems I was dealing with were, as I felt, my problems.
How did you end up joining the African National Congress, which was outlawed? It was a terrorist organization considered by the apartheid regime.
Well, I joined it, in fact, when it was legal. I wasn't technically a member. When I was a student, the ANC was for Africans only, for people of original descent only. But there were many of us who worked together with the ANC, and gradually we became absorbed into it until eventually we became full members. So I joined it when it was legal, then followed many, many years of illegality, and when finally it was unbanned, some people couldn't, they were like totally disoriented. They never knew what it was like to be legal. And they were stunned, and they were almost taken aback, because they felt the only options were functioning in clandestinity, being completely illegal and outlawed on the one hand, or what they used to call seizure of power, and they used to say the word seizure with a kind of a special emphasis on the other hand. And suddenly we were in a totally different era of negotiations, of a kind of a legality that had to be now extended so that we could finally have a democratic constitution.
Were you part of the team that was negotiating with the regime?
Yes, yes.
What role did you
play? You use the word regime, and I smile because it used to be the enemy. Then when we started negotiating, it became the regime. And then the regime in technical terms was called the South African government. And then they became the other side. And finally they ended up as the opposition. So purely semantically you can chart the whole course of negotiations. I was on the Constitutional Committee of the ANC. And I'd established a body called the South Africa Constitution Study Center. It so happens that it was SACS, S-A-C-S, which happens to be my name. But that gave me, after the bomb, it gave me about 18 months to work full-time on thinking about preparing writing for a new constitution. And we were very well prepared. We'd lived all over the world in exile, in countries east, west, north, south. We'd seen the virtues and the defects of different social political systems. It wasn't book learning. It wasn't advice we were getting from experts. It was experiential. And we were able to pull together especially the experiences of living in Africa, independent Africa, to see what the problems were and what kind of constitutional framework was needed to overcome apartheid and give basic rights to people on the one hand, and to prevent any slipping back into authoritarian practices and new forms of bureaucratic unjust control on the other.
What do you feel is most important in the South African Constitution?
The two go together. To the extent that you have an open society based on respecting the dignity of everybody, the mechanisms you put in place to prevent abuse of power are there to protect dignity of everybody. To the extent that you have fair processes to ensure that transformation takes place, that there is redistribution, that there is more equity and openness in society, but that these things happen according to fair measures and procedures, you end up with less corruption and the poor are the ones who benefit the most. So constitutionalism, in that sense, a framework within which government operates, isn't against change. It's for a decent kind of change, and that helps everybody.
We're talking to Albie Sachs. He is, the equivalent of one of our Supreme Court justices, but he does it in South Africa, where he was very active during the apartheid years as an ANC member, forced out of South Africa, lived in Mozambique, blown up by a car bomb in Mozambique, and went back to write the Constitution of South Africa to negotiate with the enemy, the regime, the government, the opposition. And
I was one of a very big team. We all wrote it and we all made various inputs. It must have been dozens and dozens of people, and eventually about 4 million people wrote in. It was a very democratic process for getting democracy.
Whose constitutions did you look at, did you most rely on?
The most helpful directly were Canada, Germany, India, and Namibia. It's convenient that it's four continents that are involved. But it wasn't for purposes of diplomacy. From Canada, we got their Charter of Rights. Our Bill of Rights is modeled very much on it's a modern charter that affirms what the rights are and allows for reasonable limitations, a kind of balancing proportionality process. And we took that very much from Canada. From Germany, we got very much the relations between central government and the provinces. With concurrent powers. It's not what's called competitive federalism, where the states are fighting against the center and vice versa. It's a notion of cooperative governance. And we, from India, we got the way a modern, if you like, secular type constitution can function in a very diverse multicultural society. And Namibia was the rehearsal for us. It was the real thing for Namibia. but a country on our borders, establishing that black and white could live together on the basis of equality in one country. United States clearly is the font of constitutionalism and many basic ideas of separation of powers, a Supreme Court with the power to invalidate laws. The whole idea of having a Bill of Rights was taken from the U.S., but most of the actual details don't correspond to the U.S. Our Bill of Rights is much more expansive. It has social and economic rights. It's not simply a restraint on the state, on government, preventing it from doing things. It also requires government to promote basic rights of people. It's very strong on gender equality. It outlaws discrimination, amongst other things, on grounds of disability, sexual orientation. So it's very, very sweeping. But also, our institutional arrangements are rather different. We have, as I mentioned, cooperative governance rather than competitive relations between the center and the devolved powers. And we have a multilingual policy that's expressly written into the Constitution. We don't have the strict separation of church and state that you have here. We have a great freedom of religion to believe and not to believe, but a concept of religious bodies being part of the nation, having an active role to play in dealing with public life and public affairs, provided they don't enforce their will on anybody, equality between the religions, and the right of non-believers not to be prejudiced in any way. So there are a number of particulars like that where we're different. Our president is not directly elected, but is chosen by parliament.
Why?
So we wanted to avoid a very, very powerful single figure as head of state. If you think of our background, the old colonial governors were really autocrats, total autocrats. Then you had traditional leadership, which had very strong democratic aspects, which had been undermined in the apartheid era, where the chiefs were built up as alternatives to the Mandelas.
Albie Sachs, South African Supreme Court Justice and author of the book The Soft Vengeance of a Freedom Fighter. It's published by University of California Press. Part two of this interview later in the week. And that does it for Democracy Now! Today. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Jillian Aldrich and Sidrak Franklin with deep appreciation. Our engineer is Matthew Finch. Our technical director is Errol Maitland. If you'd like to reach us by email, write mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. Our comment line is 212-209-2999. That's 212-209-2999. I'm Amy Goodman from the studios of WBAI in New York. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!